Welcome and thank you everybody for joining us. We're all excited to be here. I hope you had a wonderful Chagim season and Chodesh Tov to everybody. In the interest of getting right into it, I just want to say that I will post in the chat a link to the fall series. So when everyone has a chance, in case you haven't already done so, I will post a link, but I'll just let you know that after Dr. Finkelman's class today at 1 p.m., Rabbi Moshe Shulman is beginning a class on Sefer Daniel, the legacy of our Babylonian experience. Tomorrow we have also two new classes starting, Understanding the Ways of Hashem, grappling with the ways of Hashem, Naima Novetsky. And she is at 1 p.m. tomorrow on Wednesdays. And Rabbi Nathaniel Helfgott is beginning a year-long series called Together and Torn Apart, the first book of Malachim, the first book of Kings. And that's Wednesday evenings at 8:30 p.m. We're really happy and excited to have Dr. Nava Finkelman here with us today. Dr. Finkelman received her doctorate from Bar-Ilan University on the topic of foreigners and biblical narrative, which she'll be speaking with us for the next 5 weeks about. She teaches Tanakh in Midrashet Lindenbaum in Yerushalayim and in Matan, an advanced learning program for women. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Dr. Finkelman. We are both co-hosts, so what I can do now is mute everybody, and then you'll just unmute yourself. And you can begin.
Good morning. Good morning to people and good morning to Black Squares. Happy to see whoever's here. I usually don't teach on Zoom so many people. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because I usually prefer to have an open discussion. With this many people, we will not be able to have a constant back and forth because it's going to be a little bit too crazy. But And I really don't see chat. So if you write G chat questions during the class, I will not see it. But if anybody has a need to ask a question or make a comment or argue with me about anything, please feel free to unmute yourselves and do so. Okay? Because I really will miss the back and forth. Okay. Class that I'm going to teach the next few times. This and another four, I believe we have so far. Is loosely based on my doctorate, about foreigners who speak of God in biblical narrative. We're going to be looking at many sections, or several, at least five sections of Tanakh that are people know. These are not the first time you're going to see these sections. These are all common sections. These are all sections that people know very well. But we're going to look at it from a different angle. And the angle that I purposely put this slide up now so that anybody who would like to copy my email and ask me questions or contact me somehow is more than welcome to do so. The angle that I'm specifically looking at in all the texts that we're going to be looking at is the foreigner. The foreigner in all of these narratives that we're going to be looking at. The foreigner, I will define for our purposes, is someone who comes after Avram Avinu in the historical timeline. In other words, Adam HaRishon and Noah were not foreigners because there was no one for them to be foreigner to. So we're talking Avram and on. And we're talking about people who are not the covenant descendants of Avram. Okay? In other words, people who are not, who Tanakh does not consider to be Israelite. We would call them Jewish. Tanakh would call them Israelite. Okay? So we're going to be speaking about those foreigners who are not part of the nation of Israel. And we're going to be looking at narratives that have foreigners such as these, and specifically narratives in which these foreigners say something about our God, say something about Israel's God. Okay, that is our corpus. And I'm going to be picking a few select. There are, you know, dozens of these people throughout Tanakh, and I'm going to pick a few which I think are representative of the kind of thesis that I'm trying to get across. Okay. The reason that I find this interesting, this topic interesting, is because I don't think we could take, it's not a natural assumption, to have foreigners say something about our God. If we look at all the other ancient Near Eastern, texts from that time, Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptian, whatever, everybody has foreigners, right? Because everybody has enemies and everybody has diplomatic connections and everybody has slaves and everybody has people who are foreign to their nation. But all these other texts, other ancient Near Eastern texts, do not seem to be concerned with what those foreigners to their nations have to say about their own God. Okay? Am I being clear so far? Okay. Here are the type of questions which I'm going to be looking at in all these cases. And I think that if we look through this lens, through this prism of what is it that these foreigners are saying, I think we can gain a lot more from the stories in which they are found. For example, given that they're speaking about our God, because those are the cases that I choose to look at, they're going to be saying something about God. And I'm interested, first of all, what are they saying? What kind of theological messages are they giving? Are they saying something positive about our God? Are they saying something negative about our God? Okay, what is it that they're actually saying? When they speak about our God, by what name do they use to speak about our God? Okay, we know that we have several different names for God, right? Certainly in Tanakh, there's Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, there's Elohim, there's several other names. And I think that each of these names may indicate something else. And when used by foreigners, I think they may reflect different kinds of thoughts that they may have about our God. If we are talking about theological messages that these foreigners are giving, then why is it important that these messages are verbalized by the foreigners? Why can't we just have, you know, one of the Israelite characters in Tanakh say them? Or why can't we have the biblical narrator say it? What do we gain? What is the extra gain from having a foreigner voicing these messages? We don't always know who the original reader of these texts are. We are, you know, 21st century readers of these texts, and these, whatever it is that there's, what that the text says has meaning for us today as we live in modern society, except there is some sort of implied first readership, first audience back then, within whatever historical circumstances that they were living. And I think if we, and in some of the cases, certainly if we look at the implied original audience, that will give us another kind of viewpoint of what it is. Why was it important to have these messages said in the first place? One last question before we move on. And I think this is fascinating. And I only was able to answer this question after I looked at all of these texts of all the cases of foreigners in Tanakh. I think we'd be surprised to see what level of religious commitment does Tanakh expect of foreigners. Okay. We know that today Judaism is not a proselytizing religion, right? We don't expect everybody to become Jewish. But when I say author of Tanakh, I mean I'm not talking biblical criticism. I'm talking about the text itself, the Nevi'im who wrote it and Moshe who wrote it, and Moshe who wrote it at God's dictation. It's all fine. I'm talking about the formulators of these texts, okay? The ones behind the words. What level, what do they expect religiously of these foreigners? And I think that is another thing that we could see in these texts that we're going to be looking at. There are basically two types of broadly speaking, just very big division, what I would call good foreigners and bad foreigners. And if my mouse worked, you could even see that on the screen. There we go. Okay, there's the good foreigners and the bad foreigners. The difference is that good foreigners, and I'm kind of giving you a coming attractions, right? Or spoiler alert. Okay, this is at the end, we're going to look back and we're going to see there are two types of good foreigners. The good foreigners are the ones with whom the heroes of the story, the Israelites in the story, can maintain friendships, can forge treaties, and the text itself evaluates them in a positive way, as opposed to the so-called bad foreigners with which there is strife, with whom we have war, and who are evaluated negatively by the text. If I had to, again, very gross breakup of what would characterize in Tanakh's eyes a good foreigner versus a bad foreigner, I would say that the good foreigners are those who have some measure of humility, those who realize that they are not the be-all and end-all, those who realize that there is some power greater than themselves, as opposed to the bad foreigners who consider themselves the highest power. Okay, that's, you know, one of the greatest theological arguments, let's call it that, that Moshe had with Paro, right? And Sefer Shemot, where Paro thought he is, you know, a king god, and he had to be shown, no, you are not a king god. You can be a king. That's great. Okay, but there is some power above you, right? That I think is a very good, a quick and easy distinction between good foreigners and bad foreigners, those who do and do not accept that there is a power above them. One more interesting comment, I think, in this context, since I mentioned Paro and Paro as the king god. In Tanakh in general, there's rarely discussion of foreign gods as powers to be contended with. Let me say that in other words. Other gods are mentioned. We hear about the gods of this nation and that nation and the other nation, and it's usually to say they're useless, they're man-made, there's nothing there, right? It's no real competition. They're not real enough. We don't even justify, the Tanakh doesn't even justify them with having any sort of power or character or anything. They're non-entities, right? Except for maybe the story, if you know, of Eliyahu on Mount Carmel, right, where there's a competition, as if, between God and Baal. Other than that, there's no competition between, there's no recognition of these other gods. Instead of that, we have those foreign gods representative on earth, and those are the kings, right? So we're going to see a lot of strife between God and foreign kings who are bad. Again, like Paro, right? Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, I can come up with a whole bunch of other ones, right? So a lot of the people, a lot of the foreigners in our corpus of foreigners who speak of God are going to be kings who will either be subdued by God or will of themselves show some sort of appreciation of God. Okay, so that's just one small comment. All right.
Can I ask you a question?
Please do. Where does
moral behavior come into this?
Again?
Moral behavior. In other words.
Great. All right. So I actually have several good, thank you for that question, several good examples where the focus is moral behavior. I don't remember if we're going to be talking about them in this round, but my claim will be at the time that in order for someone to feel the need to behave morally, you have a prerequisite of them realizing that there is something more important or higher than themselves. If you are the king of the universe and there's no higher power, what's the point of being moral? I mean, unless you're very magnanimous, right? But morality usually comes from some sort of humility that says there is a law greater than mine. There's moral law, there's, you know, general natural law, there's whatever you want to call it, but there's something that even I have to bow down to. So I would like to categorize that question of moral behavior, not under religious behavior, but under a behavior that takes into account something higher than myself. And I would consider that one of the good foreigner traits, okay? Someone who realizes that there is something above him. There's some sort of humility there. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, yes, that does. Okay. That would be under good foreigners. Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. All right, so that was my brief introduction to this whole mini series of foreigners. And I'd like to start with our first example. And again, please feel free to butt in whenever you'd like and ask questions or make comments. Okay. The first example that we're going to be doing today, and incidentally, each of these classes will be about a different foreigner. Okay. We're going to start and finish one such foreigner in each class. So today we're going to be speaking about Melchizedek. Melchizedek is the first such foreigner in Tanakh, who speaks of God. And it's pretty easy to realize that because once Avram comes on the scene, he's Melchizedek, or the story that involves Melchizedek is basically one of the first stories that happens. All right, so we're looking at Bereshit, Perek Yud Daled. Those of you who have a Tanakh or a text in front of you, You're welcome to use it. I'm going to be putting out throughout our classes all the text that we're going to be looking at on screen, sharing with you on Zoom. So you're welcome to look at your own, or you're welcome to follow mine, whatever's more comfortable for you. Okay, good. Okay, this is the sort of thing one should never do on a Zoom slide. One should never put this many words on a Zoom slide because it's scary and uncomfortable to read. But in the interest of getting through the less important part of our section, I'm just going to read through it and translate as we go. And I hope that the next slides will be friendly. All right, here we go. Melchizedek in Bereshit Yud Dalet. Historically, the period that we're speaking about, given who these people are and who the peoples and places that they're talking about, scholars pinpoint this at about 1800 BCE. For those of you who are interested, that is more or less the date that we're talking about. And we hear a story that starts like this. Vayhi bimei Amraphel melech Shinar. In the days of, here's a story, in the days of Amraphel, who was the king of Shinar, Arioch, the king of Elasar, Kadar Laomer, the king of Elam, Vitidal, the king of Goyim. Okay, we have five kings here and where they come from. Asu milchama, they decreed war against Bera, melech Sodom, ved Birsha, the king of Amorah, Shinav, the king of Adma, and Shamever, the king of Tzvoim, and Melech Bela Hitzor. Okay, so we have the names and places of these kings. We have four kings, we have five kings. If you want, just interesting, if you want to look at the map for a second, here's what we're talking about. You know what, we'll look at the map in a minute. All right. Kol Ele, all these people, Chavru el Emek HaSidim Hu Yam HaMelech. They all came together at a place called Emek HaSidim, which the narrator is telling us is the Dead Sea, Yam HaMelech. Shtemisrei Shana Avdu et Kedar LaOmer. For 12 years, these kings were subjugated under Kedar LaOmer, who was probably the most powerful of this coalition. Ushloshisrei Shana Maradu, and in the 13th year, they rebelled against him, which probably meant they were not willing to pay taxes on him. Uvarbaisrei Shana, in the 14th year, Kedar LaOmer v'Amalachim Asher Ito, so Kedar LaOmer and the kings who were with him in his coalition, they came, v'yaku et Rifaim v'Ashterot Karnaim, and they subjugated the people called Rifaim in a place called Ashterot Karnaim, and the people called Zuzim in a place called Ham, and the people called Emim in a place called Shevegir Kiryataim, and the Chori in a place called Hararam Seir, Adel Paran, Asher Alamidbar in the desert, Yeshuvu, and they turned around and they came to a place called Ein Mishpat, which we are told is called Kadesh, and they basically were victorious over all of the Amaleki and the Emori who dwelled in a place called Chatzetzon Tamar. Okay, now let's just look at the places for a minute. Sorry. This is a map of this particular chapter. If you ever need a map of any chapter in Tanakh, Herzog has a wonderful website called HaTanakh, where you could just go through Herzog website and you click on any of their chapters in Tanakh, and then you click on map. It'll give you a map. It'll give you today's map. So this is the map of chapter 14 in Bereshit. It doesn't have all the places because we don't know where all the places are, but the first place mentioned was Ashterot Karnaim, which is up here. The second place is called Ham, which is over here. A place called Kiryataim, Sheva Kiryataim is mentioned, it's over here. And then we're going to hear in a minute about Sodom and Tsoar. If you look at all these places, I mean, it's clear given the sequence that the people who came from Mesopotamia, somewhere over here, right? They went from the northeast and they, you know, went south, right? Until the war that we're going to hear about is somewhere in Sodom, which is either south of the Dead Sea or north of the Dead Sea, unclear, but somewhere over here, okay?
If you're pointing at things with your cursor on the map, we don't see it.
You don't see my cursor. Thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate that. Here we go. Better?
Yes. Better,
okay. So I said they're coming from somewhere here, northeast Mesopotamia. They went from Ashterot Karnaim, they went through Ham, they went through Kiryataim, they eventually got to Tsoar, and the war is in Sodom, which is either here, north of Yam HaMelech, or here, south of the Dead Sea, somewhere over here, okay? So this was more or less their war path.
If I may ask, I wonder how Herzog decided that that's where Ham and Ashdod-Kirnaim are.
Well, good question. I don't know. I do know that there are other places mentioned in these psukim that are not on this map, which means that they couldn't identify that, right? So just given that, I'm guessing that these are not guesses. This is based on some sort of archaeological something, right? For example, you have Sodom here with a question mark, and you have Sodom here. So they're not sure where Sodom is. And some of the places aren't mentioned at all. And some of the places are mentioned. So, you know, do with that as you'd wish. Okay. What's interesting about all these psukim that we read so far, those of you who know any Tanakh, certainly Torah, know that the biblical authors, especially Torah, are very, very stingy with their words and their descriptions. And here we have a very, very long description, right? Lots of names, lots of places, lots of history, we're not even up to the war part yet, right? About something that is not even in Israel, right? If we look at Israel, you know, if this is the border, the closest they got was the border, right? The Sodom is somewhere on the border. This is all foreign history, right? So that's one thing to think about. Like, why are we given all the, the whole framing is very, I think, more similar to ancient Near Eastern texts. The king of this and the king of that, and they warred with this and they war with that. And, you know, it sounds like, you're watching the CNN of their day, right? Talking about foreign affairs, right? This does not sound like Tanakh. Let's keep going. Okay. We are over here. Vayitzeh melech Sodom. All right, so now we know where Sodom is, right? Sodom is either north or south of Yam HaMelech, where they reach the border of Israel, or Canaan, right? Vayitzeh melech Sodom u'melech Amora. So melech, the king of Sodom and the king of Amora and the king of Adma and the king of Tzvoim and the king of and the king named Bela, which is a place named Tzoar. Well, these four kings came. Right? 1, 2, 3.
I'm sorry. I'm counting five kings.
Five kings, right. Five kings are the losers and four kings are the strong ones. The five kings, v'yarchuita milchama be'emek sedim, and they go to war against these five kings, right? After all the other nations kind of gave in, these people are going out to fight, right? And they meet at Emek Sedim, which is somewhere near the Dead Sea. Who are they fighting against? Kedar la'omer melcheinan, v'tidal melchegoyim, v'amrafel melchshinar, v'aruyach melchassar, about four. A lot of words, a lot of blah, blah, right? And now hear what happens next. The Emek HaSidim, the place that they're fighting in, is Be'erot Be'erot Chemar. It's made, the ground there is made out of some sort of soft dirt. Vayenusu Melech Sodom Va'amora, and the king of Sodom and Amora retreated. Vayiplu Shama, and they fell into the hole. If you know, even today, those of you who know, there are sinkholes around Yam HaMelech, right? Because of all the salt, all whatever, right? So here we have a description. They fell into whatever these holes. Vanisharim Heranasu, and everybody else fled to the mountains. Vayikhud kol rechush Sodom v'Amoran, and the four kings who were the victors of this war, they took all of the property of Sodom v'Amora and all their achlam and everything they can eat or carry or wanted, and they went. Vayikhud lot. And here is the first time in this whole long story that we have some sort of indication that we may be interested in this whole, what our rabbi likes to call the First World War. Okay, finally, we have some familiar name that means something to us. All this is background. And they take Lot, and they take Lot's property. Ben Achi Avram, we hear now his connection, right? He's Avram's nephew. Avraham here is still Avram. Vayelechu, and they go. Vehu Yoshev b'Sodom. All right. They took Lot from Sodom, and you know he's one of the hostages. Vayavo palit. There's always some person left over in the battlefield who was able to escape, and he comes and he tells Avram ha'Ivri. It's interesting that Avram is called Avram ha'Ivri, right? Ivri. Rashi tells us me'ever, right? He's on the other side. He's the foreigner in this story, right? Because this is a foreign story. So to this story, Avram is the foreigner. If you want to go back to our thing, here's Elonei Mamre. He's somewhere more central, right? The war is either here or here, and they go and they call Avram. Achi Eshkol v'Achi Einar. He is dwelling in this place, Avram, with three brothers, Mamre, Eshkol and Einar, they're mentioned now because they're going to be part of his coalition later. They're his friends. And Balei Brit Avraham. Okay, they all have this treaty, Avram and his friends. Vaishna Avram kinishbach, even Avram hears that his brother or his nephew was taken hostage. Vayarak et chanichav yilidei b'util shmonasa u'shloshmot vayardof adan. And he gets together his members of his household, 318 people, and he chases them to Dan. Just quick comment here. 318 people does not sound like enough people to fight against four strong kings who just managed to conquer the entire, right, region and who just beat up the local five kings. 318 people is not a lot. If you look at Rashi, Rashi is going to tell you that those 318 people are gematria of Eliezer. So according to Rashi, he only took one person with him, right? Only Eliezer, which we're going to see later is not true. But I want you to keep that in mind, okay? Because right now the text is setting up an absolute impossible victory for Avram, right? He's going to win the war, right? But this happens a lot in Tanakh. The more you reduce his chances for winning, the greater the miracle that he actually won, right? So if you have him going against these powerful kings with just one person, certainly with 318, but certainly with one person, right? So his eventual victory is going to be all that much greater. We're going to see that. One more comment, which just if nobody ever noticed that before, is interesting. You can open your microphones if you'd like. Vayirdof ad Dan, who is Dan named for?
Dan, the son of Yaakov.
Who is not even an apple in anybody's eyes yet, right? Because we're talking about Avram before Yitzhak was born. Okay? Just an interesting comment. Vayichalek alehem laila hu ba'avadav vayakem vayirdefem ad chova sher mismol ledamasek. Right? So Avram pursues them all the way north. Here's Damasek, right? You can, you don't need Herzog to tell you where Damasek is, right? That's today's also called Damascus, right? That's the today's Damascus. When it says he pursued them ad mismol le Damasek, to the left of Damasek, in Tanakh, the normal stance is to face eastward. Right. So if you're facing eastward, and that's how one positions is, not today's globe. Right. So if you position yourself eastward, then left is north. Right. When in the previous parak, which I'm not going to show you here, but the previous parak, when Avram and Lot came back from Mitzrayim and Avram said, choose wherever you want. He said, if you go to the right, then go to the right. If you choose the left, then go to the left. He meant south and north. OK, so he pursued them until north of Damasek. And then and that's when he won the war. Vayashev et kol ha-rechush, v'gam et lot achiv, u'rechusho hishiv, v'gam et hanashim, v'gam et ha'am. Okay, so what does he return? He comes back with all of the property, and Lot, and all of Lot's property, and the women, and the people. Now that's an interesting list to look at, because if there's a list, and whenever there's a list, there has to be some sort of order to the list. Right. And if you look at the order of this list, we're talking about everyone's property, Lot, Lot's property, the women and the people. If anybody would like to comment on that, like, is it going from the least important to the more important? Is it going from the more important to the least important? Like, what is the order in that pasuk? It's kind of odd, right?
Again, largest number to the smallest number.
You're talking about number. Well, I don't know, because Lot is one person and he's fewer than women and people.
I would think that it's chiastic, perhaps.
It's chiastic, right? So here he has everybody's stuff and everybody, right? And then you have Lot and the women, I guess. And then
I would put the women with the arm.
Okay. All right. But it still gives you the I think the impression that Lot's rechush is very, very prominent, right? I think it's just a very subtle way of pointing out the priorities list, okay? At least maybe in Lot's eyes, or in somebody else's eyes, I don't know if Avram's eyes, all right? But property is a very big stuff, okay? What is the property? Property right now means loot, right? why is the loot important? And why is it important that he's returning all this? Let's think a little bit of the mentality, not today Geneva Convent mentality, but the mentality of back then, okay? If somebody wins a war and has all this stuff, right? All the loot and all the people and all the everything, okay? What is the assumption about all this stuff?
They get it.
They get it, right? They're the winner. They are the warrior that beat everybody, right? Just like if the four kings would have beat, they would have taken all the people hostage and prisoner, and that would make everybody sad, but that would be, I guess, legal, you could call it, in those days, right? So,
but I've got a question. Why?
One second, Shelley. Let me just finish the sentence, right? So according to, I think everybody's assumption, or certainly the assumption back then, is that if Avram is won this war, then all this stuff belongs to him by right. Okay. Also the people, also the women, also his nephew, also all the stuff. Okay. Yes, Shelley.
At the time, would it have been normal for somebody to go and go to war for their relative, or was it not a normal thing? In other words, would somebody else be a powerful man like Abraham, who was fairly rich at that time, if somebody else's relative had been taken in the same circumstances, would they have been expected to go to war like Abraham did? Is it a moral thing from Abraham, or is it the kind of thing that anybody would have done?
In other words, you're asking me if I think that this text is using this as an example to highlight Abraham's morality.
Yes, I want to know whether it's a common thing or not a common thing. And I want to know whether Abraham could have been king from this. He's
okay.
The winner.
Okay. Those are two questions. The first question of whether or not this was a normal thing, I have absolutely no way of knowing. I don't know enough ancient Near Eastern texts to know whether this happened or was reported on a general basis. How many people were taking hostage in a war that they had strong enough relatives to be able to go fight for them? I really have no idea. A better question, I think, is your second question. Does this mean that Avram should have been king now? Like now he has his own, right? He has his own people, he has his own stuff. Maybe he's going to be king now from this, okay? But I'm speeding through this part because I want to get to the interesting part, okay? Because if you noticed, there are 9 kings here, which is kind of an odd number because Tanakh likes these nice round numbers. So you'd expect 10, right? The 10th is going to be Melchizedek, and we're kind of steering toward Melchizedek, okay? Let's move on. Okay. Vayitze Melech Sdom Likrato. Avram, here's the picture. Avram is coming back from north to south. He's bringing with him everything, right? Everything that was taken in this war, he is now the victorious, and everybody's following him, everybody, okay? And Melech Sdom, not surprisingly, right? This is Sdom's, originally Sdom's stuff, right? Melech Sdom goes out to greet him. Vayitze Melech Sdom Likrato. Acharei Shuvo Mehakot Et Kedar LaOmer. After he comes back from vanquishing Kedar LaOmer and the kings with Kedar LaOmer, and they meet in a place called Emek Shaveh, who Emek HaMelech. Okay, so it's a place called Emek Shaveh, and we are also told it's called Emek HaMelech. Now, both of these names are very, I think, telling. Emek HaMelech, the Valley of Kings, I think is an appropriate name for a place for, you know, the king to come out. Right. And I'm using Shelley's question here to say, well, maybe Avram should be treated as a king now. I don't know. Okay. But it's interesting that it's also called Emek Shaveh, which is the valley of, let's say, equality, right? And equal. Now, one of the things that I hope we're going to see more of in when we read these texts in Tanakh is that even though we're reading this like a story, right? But the narrator is telling us the story in third person. He's describing a scene for us, right? But very often when he describes the scene, he describes it not from a neutral viewpoint, but from the viewpoint of one of the characters, all right? And now the character that we're talking about is Melech Sdom. So I wanna read between the lines here and say, as far as Melech Sdom is concerned, he's going out to meet another king, Emek Shaveh. This is equal, right? King's Dome, you Avram, right? We can negotiate. We're both on equal footing, all right? Now, this is interesting, I think, in both directions. It's interesting to say that they're equal for two reasons. First of all, I would say that they're not equal because the king's dome is a king and Avram is not a king. You know, he may be a rich guy, he may be a powerful guy, he is not a king. On the other hand, I would say this is totally not equal because you, King of Sdom, just lost everything. And you, Avram, by rights of winning the law, now have everything. Right? So that I think even though Melech Sdom or the narrator or we may be looking at this as Emek Shaveh, we still have to bear in mind that it's not really clear whether they are equals or whether one has the upper hand. And if one has the upper hand, which one of them has the upper hand? Okay? Vayomer Melech Sdom. And Melech Sdom says to Avram. Vayomer Melech Sdom el Avram. Ten li hanefesh v'harechush kach lach. Here's the deal that he's offering Avram. He says, give me the people and you keep the stuff. Okay? That's a good division, right? And anything that walks on two legs is give back to me, my people, right? And by that, if the deal goes through, that means that Melech Sdom will once again be reinstated as king, right? Because now he'll have his people again, so he can be king again.
What standing does Melech Sdom have for any of this negotiation?
Yeah, exactly, right? Keep that in mind. And he's saying, here's the deal. Here's the bargain. Give me the people, all the stuff. All right, it belongs to the people, it belongs to me, but you know what? You're a victor. Let's split half and half. Emek Shaveh, right? We're on equal footing. You take everything. Just give me the people. That's the deal that Melech Sdom is offering Avram. Vayomer Avram el Melech Sdom. And Avram responds to Melech Sdom, and he says, Harimoti yadi el Hashem el Elyon kone shamayim ba'aretz. This is an oath formula, okay? I swear by the name of Hashem El Elyon, Kone Shamayim Va'aretz, the great God who created the heavens and the earth or whatever. Imichut v'adsrochnal, not from a string to a shoelace. V'imikach mikol asher lach, and I will not take anything of what belongs to you, meaning all the stuff that is part of this deal. V'lo tomar ani esharti davram, and you shouldn't say that it is because of you that Avram is rich. Okay? You're not getting any credit, says Avram to the king of stone, for making me rich. You keep your stuff. I don't want this. Okay? Keep it all. Biladai, except for rak asher achlu anarim v'chelek anashim asher l'choyti, aner ishkol mamre hem yikol chakam. The only thing that I'm keeping is what the people who went with me, right? My soldiers, my friends, my group of people, everything that they happen to eat, you know, it's a long journey and they fought hard, whatever it is that they already consumed, that I'm keeping. I'm not going to pay you for that, right? But that's it. I'm not taking anything else, and you will not say that you enriched Avram. Okay.
It's a little bit weird. I mean, if they've already eaten it, then you can't really take it.
Right. Well, you could say, owe me for it. Okay. Right. But he's pointing it out. I guess that's about as above board as you could be to say, I already took some stuff and that's it. Okay. What do we think about the King of Sdom? Before we ask what I think about the King of Sdom, let me just ask an easier question. Does this narrative, as I read it now, make sense? Does it flow? Does it? Yeah, right? Okay, so now I'm going to tell you, and I apologize for this, I kind of tricked you, okay? Because this is not what it says in Bereishit Yudalad, and any of you who had an actual Tanakh should have raised your hand and said, wait a minute, you're skipping Pesukim. Okay. This is what it actually says. Okay? The yellow is the stuff that I skipped. Right? Now let's go back. And I'm not going to read the whole thing again. I'm just going to show you the context of what these psukim, where these psukim are placed. All right? And then you tell me if you think it flows nicely or not. Here we have like this. This is how we started. Veitzeh melech Sdom likrato, the king of Sdom went out to greet him after he came back from the war. Right? El emek sheveh hu melech emek hamelech. And I skipped to, and King of Sdom stead, right? But instead, the Tanakh inserts here three psukim, which seem, I think, to totally break up this narrative. Because if it made sense before, right, the King of Sdom came, the King of Sdom said, right? Now we're inserting something which seems, I don't know, cameo appearance, something really odd, right? Melchizedek. Melchizedek is the 10th king. However, he did not appear before. Incidentally, he does not appear after. This is a one-shot appearance of this king. A Melchizedek is mentioned in Tehillim, probably referring to David HaMelech, different Melchizedek, all right? But here we have a Melchizedek, the king of a place called Shalem, okay? And we have three psukim about Melchizedek. I'm going to read them, and then I'm going to discuss them one at a time, okay? U'Melchizedek melech Shalem hotzi lechem v'yayin, v'hu chohen le'el elyon. So Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, brought out bread and wine, and he, Melchizedek, is a priest of something called El Elyon. Okay, right now we could either write it in capital letters, El Elyon, or we could say the high, God on high, or whatever. All right, some sort of deity, because he's a priest, right? A Kohen. Ve'ivarchehu, and he blessed him. Ve'yomar, and he said, Baruch Avram le'el Elyon kone shamayim va'aretz. Blessed is Avram to this El Elyon, the creator of the heavens and the earth. Uvaruch El Elyon, and blessed is El Elyon, asher migen sarecha biadecha, who has given your enemies into your hands. Vayitem lo ma'aser mikol, and he gave him a tenth, of a tithe, T-I-T-H-E, right, of all, of everything. We're going to look at those psukim in a minute. After we hear this little, you know, insertion, then we have the whole thing that we heard about Melech Sodom. Okay? I think you will agree with me that the story flowed better before. Right? I like using the CNN, metaphor often, but if we look at what you'd expect to happen, not probably. Okay, what really happened after wars, Avram went, he won, he came back, the king of Sodom went to meet him, they had this conversation, the end, all right? This kind of weird apparition, Melchizedek, does not seem to really have much to do to the story. He does not seem to add much to the story, because right after this, we go to Melech Sodom and we hear the whole deal, and at the end, Avram goes back to his home, and that was the end of it. So I want to see, what is it that these three psukim of Melchizedek are adding to our narrative? Okay, that is, I spoke by now for about 40 minutes, and now we're finally hitting our topic. Okay. U'Melchizedek melech shalem hotzi lechem v'yayin v'uchen l'nyon. First of all, without knowing any other background, is Melchizedek Melech Shalem a good king or a bad king, and how do you know that? A good figure or a bad, good character or a bad character, and how do you know that?
Anybody that brings out food is a good character.
I'm with you on that one.
No, but okay. I mean, Torah-wise, they're going to have a problem with the Moabites and the Ammonites because they don't bring out food to us.
Very good. Okay, so first of all, you're making that wonderful connection, right? He's offering bread and wine. We happen to know that the warriors were probably not hungry because a few psukim later we heard that they had eaten, right? That's what he told King of Sodom, they had eaten. So it's not that Avram needed Melchizedek. However, certainly a point in his favor that he's being so magnanimous. What else?
He's also God-fearing.
Huh?
We don't know. He's God-fearing. We don't know which God really yet, but he's God-fearing.
Okay. That's an interesting observation, Sima. Thank you. Because let's say I know nothing about Tanakh, and I'm reading this, and I hear he's God-fearing, but he's fearing the wrong God. I don't know who this El Elyon is. Maybe it's a foreign God. You know how I know he's a foreign God? Because I know for a fact that at this point in history, Avram is the only Jew. Right? Maybe Sarah. Maybe his household, but certainly not anybody else. So I am assuming that El Elyon is Zeus, or whatever the earlier Zeus was, okay? So maybe it's a point against him that he's a Kohen to this wrong God. I don't know. Okay, good. What else?
According to what you said in the introduction.
You didn't have to believe me. Okay, we're trying to prove this now. All right. What other clues do we have if he's a good guy or a bad guy?
None, really.
Huh?
His name.
Here's a very important part. Thank you. He is called Melchizedek. Okay,
I wanted to say it, it was too late.
His name. I don't think, I may be wrong, I'm just wild guessing here, but I'm guessing that when he was born, his parents didn't name him Melchizedek. Mm-hmm. Certainly not if they didn't speak Hebrew. Okay? I don't know what Melchizedek is in whatever country he comes from. But I'm guessing that Melchizedek is what we, the reader, are supposed to think about this person's name is. Okay? So Tanakh, the author of these words, right? Called him Melchizedek. As far as I'm concerned, that is an impartial, right, objective point in his favor. He is called the King of Justice, right? That's already good.
Melech Shalem is also good.
I'm going to get to Melech Shalem in a second. Thank you. I just want to contrast this. At the beginning, I skipped over this, but look at some of the bad guys, right? Who's the King of Sodom? A guy called Berah. I don't know what Berah means. Sounds to me like Ra. Doesn't sound too good. Birsha, the king of Amorah. Sounds like Rasha. Okay? So names must mean or may mean something more than just the sounds that they're made out of. And you pointed out, Sima, Melech Shalem. A lot of scholars and Mefarshim go crazy trying to figure out, is this Yerushalayim? Is this not Yerushalayim? At the time, Yerushalayim was not called Yerushalayim. Later on, it's going to be called Yavus. I don't know. It makes us think of Yerushalayim, which is a good thing. But even if not Yerushalayim, Shalem, it's whole, right? So just his name, Melchizedek Melech Shalem, makes us think that this is a positive character, okay? And he brought out Lechem V'yayin. As we said, this is a good thing. And he is some sort of religious somebody to some deity, okay? Good.
Where was he in the World War?
We don't know. He just appeared. No clue, because we don't know where Shalem is, and he was not mentioned before.
Weren't the kings at that time all priests to their god? I mean, they're all the heads of the...
Okay, fine. Yes. I don't know where he was at the time. I'm guessing that he's somewhere geographically close. That's all I can guess. He was not part of the war. And he blesses him, and he says, Baruch Avram le'el elyon koneh shamayim la'aretz. Blessed is Avram too. Whoever Melchizedek considers is the God, right? The supreme power, the one who created the heavens and the earth, right? Uvaruch el elyon asher migen tzarecha biyadecha. And blessed is this el elyon who delivered the enemies into your hands. Okay, and this, I think, is the key point of our entire section. Because this is the first war described in Tanakh, real war. And this is the first big event, that's not a personal event, that occurred after Avram came on the scene and became Avram, right? Before this, Avram went to Mitzrayim. There was a thing with Avram and Paro and Sarai and that was like a personal deal. This is the first like international affair. This is the first time that the event. And I'm going back to my CNN, a world news event is going to be explained, okay? Now, if you read it without this section of Melchizedek, you have a very cold description of the war. We also have no idea why Avram, with his 318 people, or his one person, or whoever, his friends, how it is possible that Avram won this war. Because, I don't even know if you could say it's numbers, because if you look at the war before Avram came on the scene, there were four kings and there were five kings, and you expect the five kings to be stronger because they're five, right? But no, the four kings won. I don't know why the four kings won. I'm going to assume maybe they had a stronger army, they had better chariot, whatever it is. Don't know. But then Avram comes on the scene and we don't know why he won this war either, okay? And since this is the first such, there are lots of wars in Tanakh, this is the first such big event, okay? Melchizedek is the one who comes in our chapter, and he's the one who gives the theological explanation to what went on. And he's saying, listen, obviously you are not powerful enough on your own to win this war. If you won this war, it is because God was on your side. It is because God caused you to win this war. Now that is a totally revolutionary interpretation to to a you know, a normal realpolitik situation, right? Yes, I know that back then, also they're talking, you know, kings that went to war assumed that the god was on our side, the god was on their side. There were gods there and they were part of war. Yes. But in Tanakh, this is the first time we come across it. Okay. And we're coming across, an interpretation that says the outcome of this war was based not on Avram and his abilities, was based on God or El Elyon. Okay. Whatever this El Elyon is, this El Elyon gave Avram the victory, and Avram is blessed. Maybe he's blessed by God. Maybe God loves him. Maybe he's, I don't know. Okay. One more side point, we're getting short on time, but one more side point. When I say Baruch Avram, when Melchizedek is blessing Avram, okay, what does it mean to bless someone? You know, when a father blesses his children Friday night, right, before Kiddush, what does it mean to bless someone? It usually means, and I'd like to love to open the floor, but we're really getting short on time. It usually means, to bless someone usually means I would like to pray to or call upon he who has the power to bless to confer blessing upon this person, right? When the father blesses his sons Friday night, I don't think that the fathers think that they have a power, some supernatural power to confer blessing. It's like a tefillah, right? It's like we're saying, God, can you please bless these children or something like that, right? So when he says Baruch Avram Le'Elyon, he's saying God has blessed you, Avram. But that's a little bit complicated when he says Baruch El Elyon. How does he bless El Elyon? I'll open this for 10 seconds. What does it mean to say blessed is El Elyon?
He's already saying that El Elyon has blessed Avram.
Previously, but what is now he's saying Baruch El Elyon, but El Elyon is blessed.
Gratitude?
Right. Okay, so it could be gratitude. But it's something other than I wish somebody else will bless you, right? When you say Baruch to a God, like we say Baruch Ata Hashem, it's more of glorification or of thank or of some sort of Shevach, right? Something that you are glorifying. I can't think of any better word in English right now. But you're glorifying.
Be praise?
Praise, thank you. Okay? Praise. So when you bless El Elyon, it's praise. All right? So he's praising El Elyon, that already, you know, raises him in our eyes, whoever this El Elyon is, for giving God Avram this victory. Vayten lo ma'aser mikol. And now comes the interesting question. He gave him a tenth of everything.
Who?
Exactly. You tell me.
Melchizedek gave to Avram.
Okay, prove that.
Because the previous object, subject, person who was doing
exactly,
the action.
Exactly, because he's the object of this thing, right? That's one possibility. Okay.
The other possibility is that's why Avram says to Melchizedek, I don't want anything from you, because he's already rich. How is he so rich? He's rich because Melchizedek made him rich already.
Okay, but I want to look at the explanation for the other way. Right. If you want to look at the
English, yeah. Avram gave to Melchizedek.
That's the other option. Avram gave to Melchizedek. I have 5 more minutes. I'm going to go through this quickly.
Nava, it seems to me that why can't we say that El Elyon and Konesh Hamayim Ba'aretz actually refers to pretty much the same God that Avram is worshiping.
I'm going to look at that, but I really have, everybody close your microphones because I'd love to make this go for another 20 minutes, but they're gonna yell at me. So 5 minutes, okay? We're gonna do this quickly. Yes, it could be that Melchizedek gave Avram Maaser Mikol. It could also be that Avram gave Melchizedek Maaser Mikol. Why does this make sense, even though it's not sense and structure? First of all, because that would make it a give and take, right? He gave him bread and wine. He gave him Aser. Second of all, Avram is the one who currently has Kol, right? He just has all the Rehush. Mm-hmm. Everything is his. Third of all, to whom do you give a ma'aser? The word ma'aser is something that we connect with a Kohen, a Levi, right? Some sort of religious figure. That is whom you give a ma'aser. There are opinions in both directions. They're both convincing. I just want to get onto my point. I apologize for making this quick, right? What I want to say about this, okay? I want to say that what I think this section is doing here, And we still have two questions that are unanswered. Who is El Elyon and who gave whom the Maaser? Okay. But I think what this section is these yellow psukim about Malki Tzedek are stuck in. I think since this is our introduction to international, to Avraham Avinu and international politics, or Jews and international politics, I think it's giving us a very clear distinction between who I'm going to call the good kings and good foreigners and who I'm going to call the bad foreigners. And let me just show you this. These are the two kings that we have. We have Malki Tzedek and we have the King of Sodom, and look at the different ways they behave. Malki Tzedek, who's known, called Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem, he brings out food and he is a religious figure. We don't know yet who El Elyon is. Melech Sodom, who previously we were told is called Bera, right? He comes out and he considers himself equal to Avram. What Malki Tzedek does is bless Avram and bless God. What King of Sodom does is he says, here's the deal, take it or leave it. To the King of Sodom, Avram gives this long answer saying nothing, saying, I refuse to take anything. I will not take any of your stuff. Go away. The bottom line in Malki Tzedek is some sort of maaser. Okay? I'm stopping to share because I want to see your faces the last few minutes. Okay. Let me wrap this up and tell you what I think about this. What I think about this is like this. This is the first case, as I said, of war, and Malki Tzedek is the one who gave the theological explanation of how wars work. Okay? Once you have some, if you have someone like the King of Sodom who says, you know, you won the war, therefore you have the stuff. I'm a king. We're Shave. We can do this deal, right? With no God intervention, no anything. That is the sort of, and the assumption that, you know, if you won, then you must be stronger. We can make a deal, right? That is totally on the human plane. And that is not something that Avram is interested in taking part of. This is not the sort of person that he wants a treaty or a relationship or any sort of interdependence on at all. Leave me alone, right? If you have Malki Tzedek, right, who says, you know what? God gave you this victory. You know what? I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you lechem v'yayin. You know what? I'm going to bless you. I'm going to glorify God. I'm going to, right? That is the sort of person with whom Avram can then have a positive relationship. Now, I'll go back to my last two questions of who is El Elyon. By the way, we say El Elyon Kone Shamayim Ba'aretz in our Friday night davening, right? We say El Elyon every day in Shemona Esrei, right? This is an expression coined by Malki Tzedek. I think that, and we're going to see this in other cases, for our purposes, it's a neutral term. In other words, Malki Tzedek realizes that there is one God above others. Now, if he called that God Zeus, we would not be able to have such a positive relationship with him. But if the text calls it El Elyon, right, that is kind of, you know, we could be okay with that. You know that there's a supreme God. I know that there's a supreme God. We can both be okay with this, right? And then once you have a religious person who acts religiously, right, that is the sort of person that Avram can have a relationship with. And if I look at I don't care who gave whom this maaser. It's an expression of reciprocality. It's an expression of some sort of relationship, give and take, whatever you want to call it. This is the kind of relationship relation that Avram can have. I just want to show one more time before I stop my screen, if you don't mind. If you look at here, when Malki Tzedek says, Baruch Avram le'el elyon kone shamayim ba'aretz, and later Avram swears to the King of Sodom and he says, Harimoti yadi el Hashem el elyon kone shamayim ba'aretz. Right? The same el elyon kone shamayim ba'aretz, except Avram adds yud kei vav kei here. Again, you can look at it both ways. You could say he is correcting. Right, he's saying not your Elyon Kone Shamayim Ba'aretz. It's Yud Kei Vav Kei, who is actually Kone Shamayim Ba'aretz, right? Or you could say, you know what? We both realize there's a great. I call him by Yud Kei Vav Kei, but you can call him whatever you want, as long as you realize that there is a greater power, and you know, you glorify this power, and et cetera. You understand what I'm trying to say here, okay? That is, I think, the role of the cameo appearance of Melchizedek in this perek. Okay, now we have zero time, but I'm available if anybody still wants questions. I'm happy to hear them.
I would like to point out that Shem was still alive at this time, number one. Number two, it's a shame you didn't show a bigger map of all of the Fertile Crescent there to see where these kings came from. They can have to go a long way. You can't come straight across from east to west. You have to go all the way up following the Euphrates and then come all the way down. So they must have been pretty darn powerful to conquer Stone in the first place. And secondly, they to come back again and they conquer all these other places because they're powerful and they're basically softening up the territory before they go back and take on the Stone
River. I just want to say one thing about what you said, Asher. Thank you. You mentioned that Shem was still alive at this time. This is not Pshat. This is Chazal. Right, because we have no further mention of Shem. However, Chazal do identify Melchizedek with Shem. And there is a Gemara that says that Melchizedek Melech Shalem is Shem. Okay? So it's interesting that you brought that up.
I bring it up a bit, but if you do the actual math of the lists of things, you will see that it's clear that Shem is still alive.
Okay,
Work it out. Do the math. The way it's been traditionally done. You don't need Chazal per se. You just do the math from the text.
Okay.
But can I make one point?
Please.
I think that if you read further on, a little further on in the text, your point about Melchizedek is validated because the next parak starts with Achar Hadvarim Ha'ela Hayadvar Hashem El Avram Amachazel Leimor Al Tira Avram Anofi Magain. So he uses the same language as Melchizedek uses in praising Hail Elyon or Hail Elyon. And he also follows that with Sechar Chahar Bey. So we have a lot of the same imagery of Rechush or Sechar and Hashem saying, validating, saying, I am going to be your protector forever. And that's actually how we end
Chazal will tell you on that Pasuk. Thank you. Chazal will tell you on that Pasuk that Avram Altira. Why was he fearful? Because Avram feared that all of his brownie points as if were used up by winning the war. And now he's afraid, like, I have no merits left. And that's why Hashem said, don't fear. I'm Nachim again, right? You have beyond that. I'm again, and you'll have Sachar and don't worry about it. You're not, your bank account is not depleted here.
Right.
Yes.
Same language as Melchizedek uses, right? Magain and the, right.
Yeah. Anybody else? Well, then thank you. And I will see you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just wonderful. A whirlwind. Fabulous.
Oh, wow. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
toda.
For anybody else before you leave, the one class I forgot to mention is a Torah in Motion favorite. Shuli Mishkin is also starting a class on Thursday at 12 noon Eastern time on Jerusalem's history and places. So I didn't want to leave Shuli out of the mix. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you all same time next week. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much again.
Yiddish Tov. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.